Claremont deal was finished, we have a new organization of our own called the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights of the American Founder. We thought we'd name it after one of the most neglected and brilliant of the minds that made the Constitution. And we're here in Washington. My aide, Garrett Snedeker, here is my student in the class of 09 at Amherst. His late dad was my student in the class of 79 at Amherst. I'm a family project. Introduction reminds me of that cartoon in the New Yorker years ago of a grand figure in 19th century garb pointing out into the distance, and next to him by the pedestal, the people looked like ants. And he's pointing out, and on the pedestal it said, "Statesman, author, patriot, but still a disappointment to his mother." Now I'm really touched that you should all come out in the day and to see so many friends here. And here's Dennis, and here's Kevin, and Roger Severino. And it just struck me that this is a gathering of people who really become absorbed over the years in those moral questions at the heart of the law, who resisted the line offered by Holmes for the modern project in the law, the hope that every word of moral significance could be banished from the law altogether. And it's when the law's been formed in that way that you've seen elicited all the nasty lawyer jokes. And Tom Griffith sent me this defense of lawyers written by Jim Gordon, the former dean at the law school at Brigham Young. And he said, yes, it is true that there are many lawyers who are, you might say, arrogant, venal, corrupt, buckets of slime. He says, but on the other hand, it may be quite unjust to characterize the whole profession by 500,000 or 600,000 bad apples. Now, I want to take us back for a moment to that old British satirical review, Beyond the Fringe. The scene was from World War II, and a commander in the RAF was trying to talk one of his men into doing a kamikaze mission. And he says, "Smedling, we need someone at this moment to make a futile gesture." Now, through most of my life, the Republicans and conservatives have been people of sobriety, anchored in the world. They've not been given to utopian schemes. They've had a rough, acrid sense of moral up and down. But lately, as we've seen recently in Congress, in the outbursts and talk radio, some conservatives seem to forget that in the Madisonian system, the president does have this leverage of a veto, which is enhanced to a new level when Congress contains a large cohort of the president's own party willing to sustain a veto even when that president is evading the executive powers in a way that subverts the constitutional design. And the remarkable thing is why it took 225 years and Barack Obama to expose this simple truth, that the Madisonian system, making it harder to put together a majority to legislate, also makes it harder to put together a majority in a plural body to resist a president who is extending his powers beyond the restraints of the Constitution, especially when he has members of his own party there, to undercut any sense of their own institutional interests as members of Congress in preserving the powers of Congress. But we've seen something comparable now when it comes to the Supreme Court. The decisions on gay rights and same-sex marriage have brought to the edge of completion a project of radically changing the culture, a project that has been in the making for 50 years since the court began to teach not merely the legitimacy of contraception and abortion, but their rightness. What we've seen recently on the part of many conservatives is what may be called a kind of court derangement syndrome, because otherwise sober men and women seem driven to schemes that are entirely implausible and impracticable. So we've been asked to suppose that a country in the Senate that would not support the impeachment of Bill Clinton for lying under oath, suborning perjury, and other disgraces to the office would somehow be willing to sustain the impeachment of Anthony Kennedy, and it would not look like an attack on the independence of the judiciary. And I'm so happy to see Mary Ellen here, and my late dear friend Bob. in its own exasperation, one suggests that we turn seriously to the possibility of having certain certain controversial decisions by the Supreme Court overturned by a two-thirds vote of Congress. Well, as he surely experienced, that would be virtually impossible to command that kind of consensus in Congress. But what's all the more striking about these proposals is that they're not really necessary. For we have already within our hands, within the Constitution, the levers at hand to counter decisions of the court without bearing the burden of passing a constitutional amendment, impeaching judges, or even waiting for a new president to appoint new members of the Supreme Court who might possibly overturn the offending decision after the over the next 20 to 30 years. Here we step into the scheme that my friend David Forte describes as the president as prime elector, the man who chooses the people who really will govern us. Now, what seems to have been lost here is the deep teaching bound up with the logic and structure of the Constitution, a teaching that reminds us that the political branches, the President, Congress, have the power to weigh in with decisions of their own, decisions that can counter, narrow, and even reduce to a nullity a decision taken by the court. We have notable precedents here, beginning with Lincoln. You know, Ken Masugi and Dennis know these so well. Precedents beginning with Lincoln, extending to our own day. And the curious thing, as I say, is how this critical part of the constitutional design seems to have faded from historical memory and seems to encounter its gravest resistance these days from the conservatives. Russell Hittinger made the telling point that Lincoln could not have stood there on the Capitol, March 4th, 1861, raised his hand and vowed to protect and preserve the Constitution if that Constitution was understood now to incorporate the decision in the Dred Scott case as though it were woven into the text itself. Lincoln had just led a national movement to counter that decision, to block its Bakken extension, and overturn it. Now, some people here may remember that in June 1862, in the second year of the administration, Congress passed and Lincoln signed into law an act of ordinary legislation, not a constitution, an act of ordinary legislation to bar slavery from the territories of the United States, any territory then existing or any territory that may yet be created. And with that act, Lincoln signed Lincoln and his Congress rejected at the root the principles articulated in the decision in the Dred Scott case. Now, that act followed upon administrative decisions taken in the first days of the administration, but all those things sprang from the same logic. And no one expressed that logic more clearly than Lincoln as he reacted to the decision in Dred Scott, and he sharpened the explanation in the course of his speeches and the debates with Douglas, his Cooper Union speech in New York, and in that first inaugural address. In our own day, it's mainly Rick Santorum who's been taking up the Lincolnian argument, standing in striking contrast with John Kasich, all too willing to stamp the decision in Obergefell as the law of the land, telling us with that phrase that for him, this grave matter of marriage is settled and should have no standing among the most urgent and serious matters before us in the coming presidential election. But when Santorum voiced again the perspective of Lincoln, he was assailed by former Governor Pataki of New York for committing a species of treason to deny the standing and authority of the court was to propel us back into the days of resistance to the decisions on racial integration. But of course, that was the same charge leveled against Lincoln by Stephen Douglas, that Lincoln was teaching disrespect for the decisions of the court. And in that respect, he was joining the abolitionists in preaching lawlessness. What Lincoln sought to show then was that it was possible to respect the decisions of the court by respecting the outcome of the case, the decision handed down in regard to those two litigants, and yet one could respect that decision while not being compelled to accept, to incorporate as our own the principles articulated in that case. So as Lincoln put it in the debate with Douglas, he said, "What we don't propose that when Dred Scott has been cited to be a slave by the court, we're going to form a mob to free him. No, the issues of property settled in that case are settled in that case. But nevertheless, we do oppose that decision as a political rule, which will be binding on the voter, to vote for nobody who thinks it wrong, which will be binding on members of Congress or the President to favor no measure that does not actually concur with the principles of that decision. We don't propose to be bound by it as a political rule because it lays the foundation, not merely of enlarging and spreading out what we regard as an evil, but lays the foundation for spreading that evil into the states themselves, apart from the territories. And later in the first inaugural, any of you heard recalled this before, when Lincoln said, "I don't forget that constitutional decisions are made by the Supreme Court, nor do I deny that those decisions must be binding in any case upon the parties to a suit as to the object of that suit." Okay. At the same time, though, the candid citizen must confess that if the policy of the government upon vital questions affecting the whole people is irrevocably to be fixed by decisions of the court, the instant they are made in ordinary legislation between parties in personal actions, the people will cease to be their own rulers. That is, two litigants litigating over private injuries and perhaps litigating in a collusive way may join with a bare majority of the court, and seven people may fix the policy of the whole government and put upon the rest of us the burden of passing a constitutional amendment to overcome it. Now, that state of affairs was deeply untenable, as it is now. And as Lincoln recognized, the structure and logic behind the Constitution provided a corrective that was far more consonant with the character of this government. Now, that sense of things was manifested in the move to overturn Dred Scott through legislation. But even before that, as I noted, the administration was guided by Lincoln's understanding in the practical judgments that had to be made in its first days. And in my book, First Things, I recalled the two most striking cases here, which were brought to the administration by Senator Sumner of Massachusetts. One involved a black student in Boston who was denied a passport to study in France. And another involved a black inventor in Boston who was denied a patent by the patent office. For the same reasoning, the Dred Scott decision decided that blacks cannot be citizens, therefore, we conclude, they cannot carry a passport abroad, and therefore they're not eligible to have a patent under the laws of the United States. Now, I'd ask you to notice that these are circumstances quite remote from anything involved in the Dred Scott decisions. We didn't have people, former slaves litigating over their freedom. What we had here were two branches of the federal establishment applying what they understood to be the principle in the case to circumstances quite remote to anything involved in Dred Scott. And so the Lincoln administration quashed both decisions. They issued the passport, they issued the patent, and the Attorney General, Edward Bates, in a brilliant opinion worth reading and reading again, Bates said, "In the understanding of this administration, any black people born free in the United States are, in fact, citizens of the United States, anything in the Dred Scott decision to the contrary notwithstanding." Now, as we say these days, we fast forward. And we're at a meeting of the advisory committee to the National Advisor Institute of Health in 1987 during the second term of Ronald Reagan. And here I had several friends on that committee. Question arises whether the Institute could confine itself to research on fetal tissue drawn from spontaneous abortions and whether it could refuse then to be complicit in elective abortions by refusing to use the tissue drawn from a procedure that most members of the committee regard as wrongful. But the argument was made that Roe versus Wade was the law of the land. And as long as that was the case, the tissue drawn from the elective abortions was drawn from surgeries legitimate in the eyes of the law. But if we follow Lincoln's understanding, it should have been quite as possible for the Reagan administration to declare that this administration respected the outcome of that case in regard to those litigants, but it has never accepted the deep principle articulated in that case about the rightness of abortion. And therefore, it could have been said, in the understanding of this administration, elective abortions are in many cases wrongful procedures. We'll not be complicit in that wrong by making use of tissues drawn in that way. Now, I would submit to you that that kind of a stand could be wrong only if Lincoln were wrong. And frankly, I don't see any way under this Constitution that Lincoln could have been wrong. But the irony here is that Republicans continue to act as though they've never heard this reasoning filed by Lincoln and his party or the precedents that support this understanding. Actually, can I be a glass of water?
Sure.
Actually, this recalls a moment 20 years ago in one of those meetings in New York with Father Newhouse, where Clarence Thomas, tutored by Ken Lasuki, and Robbie George and Mike McConnell and I were trying to go over this again, Lincoln's understanding. And Clarence was looking there with black eyes, and we turned to him and said, well? And he said, but no one understands that anymore. I said, but you can teach. You're in a supreme position to teach. And what's here that can't be understood? Now, on the other hand, the Republicans resist this, profess to not to recall it, and the Democrats profess to be scandalized by it, but they keep acting upon this understanding. We've had many examples here, but one of the most striking, I think, was the one years ago, the criticism of President Reagan for his refusal to accept the constitutionality of the War Powers Act. That was the act in 1973 in which the Democrats were trying to walk away from their responsibility for the war in Vietnam. The act incorporated the legislative veto. The president could deploy forces, and the Congress would have 90 days in which to veto it, and they could veto it simply by doing nothing. It was the worst kind of veto. You can overturn an explicit decision with a decision unformed. Okay. That act sprung from the reaction to the war in Vietnam, and it had, for Senator Gary Hart, a kind of nearly religious significance. Hart railed at President Reagan for daring to suggest that as president he could indulge his own convictions about the constitutionality of any measure. And he insists the president is bound by the laws of the United States, whether he likes them or not. If he thinks it's unconstitutional, we can test this before the Supreme Court. Well, with a surprising blitheness, and perhaps because he simply had not noticed, Senator Hart passed by the rather unsettling fact that the court, several months earlier, had struck down the legislative veto in the Chadha case. That was a case involving immigration. Decisions could be made to admit certain classes of immigrants, but one committee of the House was authorized to use the legislative veto in rescinding the decision. But that legislative veto was at the heart of what the War Powers, that was what the War Powers Act was about. Once the Supreme Court had struck down the legislative veto in the Chadha case, that decision should have been enough to strike down the War Powers Act as well. And yet, that was not evidently enough for Senator Hart. He continued to act and speak as though the War Powers Act was constitutional. And indeed, Congress has since then have kept reenacting the legislative veto and a host of measures. His position could be explained only in this way, I suggest. He would apparently respect the decision of the court as it bore, in the case of Chadha and the litigants of that case. He would narrow the case to holding about immigration, but he would not accept the broader principle articulated in that case, the principle about the wrongness of the legislative veto. So as a political officer of high standing and responsibility, Hart would reserve his freedom to reach his own judgment on the constitutionality of the War Powers Act, quite apart from anything the Supreme Court said. That is to say, Hart struck a posture of high outrage because President Reagan had dared to claim for himself precisely the same freedom and authority that Senator Hart claimed, without being much aware that he was claiming it. Now, I take that incident to mark this point, which may now transcend the differences between the parties, the fact that Lincoln's understanding can be found woven into the practice of liberals. There would appear to be something in the structure of the separation of powers that permits Congress to get around the Chadha case. But if we then summoned our powers of reflection to ask, what is that something? What's the rationale that informs us? We'd find ourselves just backing into Lincoln's understanding again. There was that moment when we were doing the Defense of Marriage Act, when we were actually inviting Congress to provide guidance for the court, And we said, this is whatever Roe versus Wade means. It couldn't mean the right to kill a child born alive. And my nemesis, Jerry Naylor from Greenwich Village, Jerry comes in and says, I like this professor. We still have the Congress start revising case of the court. Maybe we should try our hand at revising Bush versus Gore. I said, Congressman, that is a terrific idea. The practice is useful. You should try your hand at that. Just remember, you have to respect the outcome of that case in regard to those two litigants. But Senator Hart had it right beyond his grasp. For Senator, remember, the legislative branch did have the authority to reach his own judgment. John Marshall, Marbury versus Madison, never claimed that judges alone had the responsibility to make judgments on constitutionality. The judges were compelled to consider whether the statutes they were asked to apply and interpret were also compatible with the fundamental law. That test arose for judges as a necessary task of deciding cases, but it arose also for members of Congress and President to decide whether these measures coming under their hand, not only would they work, but were they also compatible with the fundamental law. When we were holding our hearings on the Defense of Marriage Act back in 1996, my old buddy Barney Franks of Massachusetts leaned and said, I think this whole thing is unconstitutional. To which I said, Congressman, you make our very point. Yes, that's right. If you think it's unconstitutional, you have the obligation and responsibility to make that judgment now. Right? John Noonan, before he became a federal judge, did an interesting piece in which he noted the string of precedents in which Congress came to take position on a matter of constitutionality at odds with the judgment handed down by the court, and the court gave way. It accepted the judgment offered, pressed by the Congress. Well, there's no need to review the list, and maybe I just want to recall some briefly. Some of the lawyers who may remember Katzenbach versus Morgan from 1966, where they're dealing with the court about several years earlier, I think it was the Lassiter case, had sustained literacy tests in the states as quite compatible with the Constitution. But now they're dealing with a case where Bobby Kennedy, as a senator from New York, had slipped a rider in enfranchising people who had attended American flag schools through the sixth grade, which is a device for enfranchising Puerto Ricans in New York for the elections there. And Justice Brennan, of all people, said, yes, Your Honor, this really is at odds with the decision we've reached. The Congress and the court come to, but the Congress need not give way. The Congress could have it right. Okay. Now, over the years, I've written a lot, as my readers know, in making the case, explaining the rationale for those modest moves in the law that plant premises for the pro-life movement. As it says in the Bible, I've made that case coming in and going out. For that modest first step that John mentioned, that move to protect the child born alive in this awful legislative language, piling nouns as adjectives about the Born Alive Infants Protection Act. No, it wasn't. Born Alive Survivors. Right. And recently, we've been able to return to the floor of the House in a move led by our redoubtable friend Trent Franks of Arizona to restore the penalties that had been stripped from that original bill. The penalties had been removed by Charles Kennedy, the chairman of the committee, for the sake of averting a veto from Bill Clinton. I didn't think that was necessary. I didn't think Clinton would have vetoed that bill. We're trying in that bill to plant the premise that even the child marked for an abortion had a claim to the protection of the law. But what people may not realize is that in making that move, we're also seeking to restore the understanding that the political branches have a legitimate role under this Constitution to check and counter as well as amplify the judgments of the court. So we sought to plant those premises by recovering that tradition of putting in a preamble for the premises and purposes of the bill. And that became both useful and necessary because the other side sought to cope with our bill with Jerry Nagler's advice, don't give them an argument. It's too modest. Just go along with it. Don't give them an argument. And so we're trying to get the argument by raising the level of tension, by going to the floor. So we'd say, it doesn't make sense to us that you vote for this bill unless you concede that even a child marked for an abortion has a claim to the protection of the law that cannot pivot on whether anyone wants her, whether she served the interest of anyone else. Now, do we have that wrong? Are you saying you protect the child only because it pleases you to protect the child, and you would cease to protect her when it ceases to please you? Well, then tell us that. Amend this. Offer something. Well, we did manage to elicit the conflict, but not the one we're looking for. Instead, we had a contingent of pro-choice Republicans meet with the leadership and threaten to join with the Democrats in closing down the House at the height of the presidential election. If we went to the floor with those inflammatory findings, and Charles Kennedy's saying, what, inflammatory? You think there's a constituency for infanticide back in your district? He said, no, the function of leadership, just quiet, you know, they want to tear up their rubber sheets, you know, give them something to, you know, calm them down. But Henry Hyde went along with them, and, you know, and Henry's logic goes, to preserve a pro-life Congress, you have to have a Republican majority, which means we have to go to the rescue of pro-choice Republicans hanging on by a thread in their district. And Steve Kai Kendall in Los Angeles said this thing would make life difficult for him. But along with the shelving of the preamble, we lost the passage that I wanted more than anything else. And now, as we revisit that bill to restore the penalties, my own overriding object is to insert now the one we didn't get. This matter now also runs beyond the matter of abortion, for what we can put on the table now about the power of Congress and the political branches to counter the court on abortion can also give us guidance on what Republicans could do right now in countering Obergefell. And not putting aside these issues while we're waiting for a constitutional amendment. The teaching here involved that we tried to put in really involved us going back to Chief Justice Marshall in the classic case of Collins versus Virginia. And Marshall argued there that the judicial power of every well-constituted government must be coextensive with the legislative and be capable of deciding every judicial question which grows out of the Constitution and the laws. And yet, even jurists seem to be taken by surprise by the corollary of that axiom, that the legislative power must be coextensive with the judicial power. Something quite simple and primary seems to elude persistently even our best minds, and that is, any issue that becomes the proper business of the federal courts becomes the proper business of the federal government. They have to be reminded the federal courts are part of the federal government. I can't tell me how many hours I put in with donors at Amherst saying, can we just get the federal government out of this business? And I'd say, oh, my guys would go along with that. You mean you want to put the federal courts out of it too, right? Oh, the federal courts are not part of the federal government. Understand that. When the Supreme Court articulated a right to abortion anchored in the federal constitution, abortion became overnight an issue in our national politics. And so we could say that any issue that comes under the competence of the federal judiciary must come presumptively at least within the reach of the federal legislature as well. And so what we propose that we have on the base on going right now, and Trent promises me we can get this in. And one of the things we'll be doing, we had was this. Here's the language. If the Supreme Court can articulate new rights under the 14th Amendment, say a right to abortion, the legislative branch must be empowered to vindicate those same rights on the same clause in the Constitution where the court claims to find them, and in filling them out, marking their limits. In this case, we say whatever Roe versus Wade meant, it couldn't possibly have meant the right to kill a child who survives. The one thing we say that should not be tenable under this Constitution is that the court can articulate new rights and then assign to itself a monopoly of the legislative power in shaping those rights. To deny that proposition is to remove the Supreme Court from the web of restraints that mark the character and logic of this Constitution. So Trent promises me we'll get this in. And it doesn't take much imagination to see how this situation would have been transformed if the political class, including the judges, had understood these things in this way in 1973. First, it would have been salutary for the judges to understand that once they introduced abortion as a constitutional right and made it overnight into an issue of our national politics, they could not keep control of this issue themselves. If Congress had to weigh in on this matter of 1973, it's fairly clear that the right to abortion would have been scaled down to where the laws essentially were in the 70s and where most people would have them today. That women would have access to abortion when their lives were in danger of vanishingly rare situation now. And a few states like New York and California may have more liberal provisions. But in that case, the hearings over confirmation of the court would not have turned into the poisonous affairs they become, poisoning not only our hearings, but poisoning our politics as well. The issue of abortion might not have become the central issue in defining the Democratic Party and creating a new division in our politics based on lines of the culture war with abortion, contraception, gay marriage. And may I add, there would have not have been a need for vast throngs of our people filling the streets of Washington in the bitter cold of January, for there would have been no need to seek the overruling of Roe, and no need then to keep affirming anew the supremacy of the Supreme Court in shaping our lives and institutions, for the court would not have that supremacy. Now, as I say, we stated this point in the form of a preamble. It doesn't require an enactment of Congress, but simply implicit in the logic we think of the Constitution, the separation of power. But it could be quite important to have a statement made in a public document for the sake of raising that point to the level of a public awareness and teaching the point again to members of Congress that they bear this authority. And with that done, we could set the groundwork for bringing the political branches back into play in the case of marriage as well. When a Republican candidate for president says that he favors a constitutional amendment on marriage, he's trying to tell us that he agrees with our ends, but there's nothing serious he's prepared to do right now. And what that means is that he's prepared to live with the scheme of same-sex marriage getting deeply planted in our laws, with a weave of supporting regulations, so that same-sex marriage becomes ever harder to dislodge. My own conviction now as ever is that it becomes necessary to put something on the table. Put something on the table now, if only to show that this matter has not been settled and that we're not essentially acquiescing in the dismantling of marriage and the attack on the religious that has been licensed and fueled by this decision. Well, what might we put on the table? Roger's here, and I was taken a couple of years ago by Carrie Severino's marvelous proposal of a redo of DOMA, but that's D-O-M-M-A, the Defense of Monogamous Marriage Act. As the dissenters in Obergefell, the majority cannot explain why their decision could possibly preclude, in any case, the case for plural marriage, whether polygamous or polyamorous. This was the argument that some of us were making 19 years ago when doing the Defense of Marriage Act, that once marriage is separated from the telos of begetting and nurturing children, once it's seen as a loving relation among adults, then what principle confines us to a coupling? What is it to say that the people say our love is not confined to a coupling, but woven into a larger ensemble of three or more? We've already seen people making the case. And more cases are sure to arise as people insist on knowing just why they are not free to marry the ones they love. Congress could take this simple point as a way of putting something on the table and provide at least the conclusion that the court wished to provide but couldn't explain. In that respect, the Congress could be doing the court a favor. The Congress may itself act to confine marriage to two persons. We could do DOMA again, but another way. We'd say, yes, federal law will consider a marriage as involving no more than two people. And yes, we could do the state provision again, that a state need not be obliged to respect a marriage coming in from another state containing more than two people. The court could avoid taking this step. Well, the court here would be in a position of which they would face the need to affirm, as they once denied, that the federal government may indeed form a policy on the subject of marriage. And they may be compelled to acknowledge again that, yes, the state may put up certain moral barriers to certain kinds of marriages. They could avoid taking these steps if they wish to affirm now polygamy and polyandry. But even the Obergefell 5 may not be prepared to do that just yet. Just yet. Yes, people say, yeah, but that still would leave same-sex marriage there undisturbed. Yes, but this would be a striking way of making the point for people to learn anew that Congress or the political branches may indeed weigh in countering and narrowing the judgments made by the court. And if members of the court can see again that these levers are there, it's open to our moral imagination as to what steps may come next. In the case of abortion, we'd be having Congress say that whatever was meant by Roe versus Wade, it surely could have meant the right to kill a child born alive who survives the abortion. And if Congress can say that, it may come back a bit later and say whatever Roe versus Wade meant, it surely didn't mean the right to kill a child out of the speculation that the child will have Down syndrome or be deaf. Those features don't justify the killing of any other human being right now. The Congress could go on then to the matter of protecting the child in the womb with a beating heart, or the fetus able to feel intense pain, or the child marked for abortion because she's of the wrong sex. In these moves, Congress would be putting the question to the court as it did in Lincoln's time, in measure designed to cut back Dred Scott. We urge you to take a sober second look at what you've done and consider that you might have been mistaken. We could move this level to the level of a constitutional amendment, but that may not be necessary. Look again. My point of late has been that we can do this on abortion, we can do it as well on marriage. Over a year ago, when the court was having the oral argument in the Hobby Lobby case, the area outside the court was filled with young women proclaiming not only their right to contraception, but that this right was so basic that their employers or the country should be obliged to pay for it. And one had to think, how do we get to this point with a generation of young women shaped to this vulgar understanding? And the answer, I think, was clear. All this came not simply from trends in the culture, but from the Supreme Court itself, promoting from on high the moral rightness of contraception, first for married couples, but then later for the unmarried. The court itself, one realizes, has been a force in the shaping of the culture. What we had here were the clearest example of Aristotle's point, that the polis, the polity, shapes the moral character of its people by what it teaches through the laws. And yet we keep finding ourselves in situations in which the court takes these momentous steps that portend a serious shift in the culture, and we're told by earnest people that we should give up on politics and work on changing the culture. When we gathered in Pittsburgh for the signing of that bill back in 2002, President Bush came up and said, God, this is a first step in the changing of the culture. Well, if it was, had to acknowledge he had absolutely no part in it. He didn't speak to it. He didn't even endorse it. When we thought this would be the easiest one for a Bush to talk about, he didn't even endorse it. The endorsement had to come from the executive office of the president. So we had the sense, if it were a matter of changing the culture, clearly you didn't have a hand in it, and evidently he didn't consider it part of his own job description. So how many times, we must wonder, will our experience dramatically belie the cliché about changing the culture outside of politics, while that cliché remains remarkably unchallenged as venerable wisdom? On this matter, as I bring this to a close, I'm ever with Aristotle and the Greeks, and with a common sense of ordinary people who recognize that the courts carry a halo of moral teaching. And that's why it's ever more imperative for the parts of our government to take up those levers of moral teaching when they possess those levers in full enough measure. What remains for our political class is to summon the wit and the nerve simply to put something on the table now. And when they act to bar the killing of a child born alive, or bar polygamy and the polyamorous, when they act to preserve marriage as a union of one man and one woman, they will find themselves speaking things that ordinary folk will readily recognize as things they've known all along. I used to invoke at times like this Plato's teaching in the Meno, that all of our knowledge is a matter mainly of remembering, a matter of unlocking and drawing out the implications tucked away in the things we already know. And so once again, we may find ourselves saying that for this country, with its impressive writings and jurisprudence of the founding, it's a matter of remembering what our lawyers and judges and our people once used to know. Thanks very much.
We have some time for a few questions. Any questions for Dr. Hart?
We've solved it. Okay. Joe Cosby.
Yes. Very interesting. Thank you for your remarks. And I'm drawn on the question of modest step on gay marriage. I'm wondering what your reaction is to the current efforts, kind of religious restoration approach that would allow ministers and whomever to take either engage or not engage in gay marriage, and for companies and so forth to be able to do that. How do you feel about that, both from a practical point of view and in terms of being able to forward this point that you're trying to make?
The prudent say this is to say, I wish them luck. I wish it works. The thing that's getting in the way, people don't quite realize, is that the other side thinks, I really understand the logic of morals. The logic of morals, you know, Aquinas said, the right and good is that which we're obliged to do, the wrong is that which we should repress or punish. Remember Lincoln saying, if slavery were right, all words against it would indeed be wrong and could be legitimately swept aside. If I concede to you it's right, then I would concede to you your claim to censor the federal mail, to screen out the abolitionist literature, if it is right. Now, these people come along and say, we insist on the rightness, the moral rightness of our position. Those who resist it are being wrongful. You did not invoke your religious belief when it came to getting an exemption from the laws that barred racial discrimination. So why would you get an exemption now? It can't be settled at the level of belief. It has to be, the argument has to address the substance of the matter. We say that this is not like the matter of discriminating the base of race. It leaves marriage intact. This alters the institution. There's something wrong with it. Our people think they could somehow take the low door under the wall. They're going to resolve this issue by simply invoking beliefs. And my sense is that's not. Kai Feldblum, our friend Kai Feldblum at Georgetown, descended from a line of rabbis, already has treated that claim with utter contempt. No, of course, we're not accepting your claim of religious belief standing against what we take to be a deep moral truth. So my claim is we're not going to be able to make it at the level simply of defending beliefs. It's going to have to proceed to the argument over the substance itself.
Any other questions?
Okay, if there are no other counsel, I'm going to do counsel answer to you. Okay, go ahead.
I'm curious if you could point to an example or examples where the Supreme Court and the political, particularly the presidency, have disagreed and there's been they talk about these constitutional crises. Where would be one where, what was the resolution, or was there have there been an issue where the president says, no, I'm right on this constitutional issue, and the Supreme Court says, no, I'm right, and was there ever a situation like that? What would be the...
Well, I think John Newton had a list of things, where, and I could just go back and have his list where the Congress, say the states could not interfere with the flow of commerce, but yes, in the McCarran Act, we start allowing them to start regulating insurance. The number of cases of that kind. And there are cases, of course, where it just doesn't rise to the level of a challenge. The deal of the destroyers to the British for bases. We have this new memoir of Robert Jackson just divulged a couple of years ago when he told FDR, "You don't own those destroyers; they're not yours to trade. You're going to have to certify to Congress." This is a So I suggest you just do it.
If you have let's say the Congress passed and the president signed a law saying exactly what the marriage is between like they did with DOMA, but let's say they did it again, right? And not just protecting the law, but this is the law of the land. And the Supreme Court rules, no, this is unconstitutional. What would happen in that situation when they're clearly on opposite sides. I mean, does the Supreme Court have any higher authority in constitutional interpretation?
No, I don't. I don't think anywhere in the Constitution where it says they have the last word. No one gets the last word in this system.
Okay.
It's an ongoing conversation. So you didn't get it right this time, we'll try it again. We'll try dishing it up. And maybe, what's the old line? A year from now, the horse may talk, the king may die, you know, all kinds of things can happen. Maybe a Republican will get elected again, and maybe they'll get it right at an appointment, and we'll have a chance to revisit Obergefell. Meantime, you're maybe buying for time. In the meantime, you say to Anthony Kennedy, did you really mean to go this far? Have you really opened it this far? Ah, then if you admit that there are certain limits that Congress can articulate, well, then maybe there are other things we can revisit as well to make this a bit more complicated for you and come back again. Look, even with Obama on the recess appointments, he started considering the decision on recess appointments to govern those litigants. But he wanted to keep making appointments, right? We'll just ignore it and just go on. So there is real flexibility in the system. It becomes a time, a willingness kind of to summon the nerve. You see, we get back there, looking back at the histories that we heard later that people in Congress did not want FDR to bring it forth. They didn't want to take responsibility for it. So this is what we get quite often, that, Congress could do it, but we don't want to take the responsibility for it, so better that you just do it. Yeah. Yeah, just that.
Professor, your thoughts on including in legislations, particularly legislation where the court has shown a propensity to ignore democratic principles, provisions stripping the court of jurisdiction?
I'm for it. People seem to forget that the main precedents are liberal precedents, right? In the Norris LaGuardia Act, right? When judges were entering in quickly to issue injunctions to break strikes, and we took that away. We took the authority of to do that. And the Republican Congress was starting to do that. They want to start moving to sort of taking certain issues of marriage just out of the courts. Yeah, I think there's perfect rationale for doing that. Now, I hear people saying, it's fallen into desuetude. It's there in the Constitution, but it hasn't really been used. It's in the Constitution, right? The other side uses it for their ends. They say, well, once again, it's so much of this is a matter of raising the question whether the other side is willing to live by the same laws they hand down for others. Bill Bennett and I did a piece during the impeachment of Clinton to say, look, we just want to know where those rules that were put in place for Mr. Nixon, get impeached for suborning perjury. Just tell us, are those rules still in play? It's no trivial thing to use the measures to see if the other side will simply respect the rules that they themselves hand down. And with that sober line, that may be enough to bring this moment to a close.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Real quickly, we have a small token of appreciation that we give to all of our speakers. And hope you will remember us fondly.
Oh, that's nice. I've got my Thomas More medallion from the Thomas More Society in Charlotte, and I've got a statue of Thomas More from the Thomas More Society in Boston, but this is one my wife would have had. I'll hang this one up. I love this one. That's nice, John.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for coming. And we will hope to see you at the CIC in December for our poetry readings for Christmas. You gotta run. Thank you.
So these things came from a monastery in California, and the monks in this monastery fled China because of persecution.
Oh, that's a special.
Pleasure meeting you.
Thank you.